It's a piece called Sunrise from Chet Atkins. It kind of goes hand in glove with the little skit by Ben and Phineas there on how the ancients first studied the skies and the stars and took measurements and took notes and discovered, hey, there are cycles up there. And we've been discovering things about time ever since. Good morning to you. It's about 12 minutes now past the hour. 8 o'clock here, the hour being, on a Broken Road Radio Tuesday. Dr. Don Clark joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. Dr. Don, a biochemist and member of the Board of Creation Moments. And Don, the topic today is time and bioclock specifically. We've been looking at the skies forever and analyzing and discovering cycles. And time is a real mystery to me. Sometimes I think time is a joke. It's really the result. It's a perception based upon cycles of things, you know, our position in the orbit around the sun. We get back to that position in the case of Earth about every 365 and a quarter days, and so you look at the sky and the stars are in the same position, and you think, oh, now I'm a year older. I don't know how long we've been operating on that presumption, but for thousands of years. It turns out that there's time on a very large scale like that, but also time on a very small scale, and that's our topic today. Don, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're growing?
Doing quite well, yes. A little tired because we're in harvest season now.
Yeah, and you're picking your wrangling grapes out there. Yeah.
It starts some frantic activity during the day or so that we harvest, and then after that, you've got processing the juice and starting fermentation and keeping the fermentation going and that type of stuff. So we're quite busy in the vineyard and in the winery.
Mm-hmm. Now, I saw your note on Facebook that you were harvesting. Is it muscadine that your most recent grape picking effort? And then you've got several more fields to do, you?
Yes, we do. No, we harvested the muscat.
Muscat, okay.
It's actually it's a Muscat Blanc is the varietal, mm-hmm. and it makes the Moscato wine.
Oh, okay.
So we typically turn that that particular wine into our sweet wine. So we only offer one sweet wine, and it's the Moscato,
mm-hmm.
And it's made from that grape.
Mm-hmm.
So we harvested that last Saturday, and this Saturday we hope to harvest our Blanc du Bois.
Mm-hmm.
Which we call Blondie, but that one make into a dry white wine.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking, we got to get your logo. I'd like to put a link to your website up on our website, because I'm sure that the listeners have been listening to you over the years here. They would love to know more about the winery and what it is you offer. So we'll do that. It's, you know, nothing against commercials here. That's just fine. We'll put that on the website.
Okay, that sounds great.
See what happens. Yeah. Yeah. Did you say it sounds grape? What?
It sounds grape, yeah.
Oh, no, okay.
I said it sounded great, turned out to be grape.
Well, think about the seasons and those cycles up there. And the earth goes round and round, and the sun moves around the sky, and we get summer, fall, and winter, and spring. But the notion that there's something on the receiving end that causes plants and animals to respond to that cycle in the sky is what's amazing. This is a very complicated thing, circadian clocks, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, because we normally would think of, circadian rhythm as being just a 24-hour, day-night cycle, for mm-hmm. example. But it turns out that it's, as with anything in biology, it's far more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard the term biorhythm, and I don't really know what that means, but it has to do with, I guess, moods or physical states. And was it like 33-day cycle for men, and maybe something different for women? I suspect there's a whole lot of guessing going on, and people who really don't know what these are about that are making comments. Are people studying this stuff?
Well, they are, but to try to take even a more complex organism, let's say like man, for mm-hmm. example, and try to break down all the clocks that we might have, started with most research is done with a simpler, in quote, organism. In this case, it's the fruit fly. So the fruit fly has been studied, and everything about the fruit fly has not even been uncovered, especially in this area, because it's just like, this is new research. We didn't know, for example, that there was such thing. Okay, there's a central clock. We can understand that. You know, fruit fly and animals need to rest, and so there's that circadian rhythm which we normally think about. And that clock pretty much resides within the brain of the organism. But there's all kinds of peripheral clocks in different tissues that dictate how the tissue functions, for example, and when it functions, and how it interacts with other tissues. Many of these peripheral clocks are connected to the central clock, and the central clock kind of orchestrates. You can think of it as a symphony, if you will. The central clock kind of orchestrates the master plan, and these peripheral clocks keep the tissue functioning as it's supposed to be functioning. We might, think of that as, for example, the digestion in the digestive system, that all would need to be kind of programmed or worked out in a systematic way. Otherwise, you'd have chaos. I mean, you eat something, you got to chew it up, but when you're chewing it up, you get saliva, which has enzymes in it, and it starts to break down the food that you eat. It goes into your obviously in your stomach. The stomach pumps in acid and other bile acids and various other things that are needed to break down the food, and eventually it rhythmically, your intestines and your stomach are in a rhythmic pattern to move that food that you've eaten down the intestinal tract and eventually into your the small intestines and the large intestines, and then eventually out. And all of that is a rhythm. If there was no rhythm to it, you would have blockages. You'd have in your intestinal tract, for example, and that would be actually quite painful. And there obviously was a recent movie about one little girl who had such a problem where her intestines weren't working. They didn't have that function to move the food and through her system. So these clocks are very, very important to life, and like I said, they help dictate what's going to happen at a particular time. The clocks can be extremely small, for example, and can reside within the nucleus of the cell.
Now that I have a question. You say they're small, so there's a size to these clocks. I'm picturing chemicals working on a molecular level, and maybe I don't know, in conjunction with electronic fields, or does electricity have something? We can picture a watch or a clock in our minds because we relate to them every day. Gears and wheels to turn, and you can see how one gear determines the speed of rotation of another gear, and it all works together. So the hands on the clock, I'm taking analog here. And now there's digital, which is electronic, and it's based on crystals and electronic frequencies through the crystals. But these aren't these chemical clocks?
Chemical and electrical clocks.
And
yes.
Electrical. Okay.
Because in order to connect the functionality of these peripheral clocks, for example, and peripheral, distal, I mean, whatever you want to call them, they call them peripheral, but whatever they have to, if they're communicating with each other, if a signal is getting from one point to, let's say, the central clock, or the central clock is sending out a signal to these others, there has to be some type of electrical connection between the two. So that's where the electrical component comes in. It, of course, all of these, since we're talking about biology, all of it is a chemical reaction or reactions of some sort. For example, in the fruit fly, they have photoreceptors that make up part of their clocks, and some of the photoreceptors are clocks, and some of them don't have any clock function. But when the receptor receives a photon, it signals the clock to tick, and off it goes. And in other cases, it, you know, it just receives the photon, and something else happens. So you've got photoreceptor type of clocks, and like I said, they do really, the system is so complex, they don't even quite, to say they don't even quite understand it is an understatement. Mm-hmm. They don't understand it, and it hasn't all been worked out. And it may not be all worked out, in not only in our lifetime, but ever, because it's so complex.
Another question. There are elements in the earth like silicon and selenium and other things that we've learned to use in electronic components to help them run in a synthesized and in a coordinated fashion, according to some timekeeping device. And every computer has a clock, for example, that makes everything run together. Is this all dependent on, for example, some of the heavy metals or elements that we consume in our diet? In other words, do our bio clocks depend on some of the same elements that electronic clocks do? In other words, do we need selenium, and do we need, I don't know, silicon and other things in our diet? Is that what runs this stuff?
Well, we do need some of those elements, but whether or not they're part of the clock. Mm-hmm. I don't think they've figured that out yet.
Okay.
I mean, most of them seem to be obviously proteins. Mm-hmm. Proteins are involved because it's pretty much the building block of everything in life, between proteins and polysaccharides and all this other stuff. And then you have, for example, in terms of a photoreceptor, you need to have some type of compound that is actually going to receive the photon. Mm-hmm. And those tend to be porphyrin type of structures, fairly large molecules that are quite aromatic. That doesn't mean that they smell good. It just means mm-hmm. it's the type of chemical that they're made up of. And they accept excitation, for example, by light, which then turns it into an electronic signal, and they lose an electron. And that's how, for example, you can see, because that kind of starts the process. And then once that electron then gets cascaded through a system, and ultimately produces an electrical pulse is used in that part of the organism, or that part of the tissue, to do something.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, you know, there might be obviously some of these compounds. Whether they're central to that system, I don't think they've drilled down that deeply as yet. Most of this has been done with immunofluorescent type of technology, where you have you take an antibody, you attach a fluorescent compound to it, so the antibody sticks to a specific protein. You then bathe the tissue that you're studying with that particular antibody fluorescent compound. And then you excite it, and then you can actually see where that particular protein is within the tissue. That technology kind of came out when I was in biochemistry and in bioengineering several years ago. So it's been around. The technology for studying these things has been around, but it's more on a gross scale than a individual molecular, you know, scale, is, mm-hmm. If you will.
Well, the question now, comes to mind. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to mention that sometimes these things are in not only so small, but those clocks that are in our nucleus, for example, are very, very important, because it dictates when a gene is turned on. You know, normally we think, okay, you just you turn on a light switch, you turn on a gene, and a gene makes a protein, And the protein gets carried away and goes to wherever it's supposed to go. We now know that all of that is under control. It's not a random process. But with this, what's being discovered is with these clocks, one particular protein might be being made, but another related protein that is going to build something, for example, has to be turned on in a specific sequence once that first protein is started. So it's like, okay, this first protein, I need this protein to make, you know, let's say part of a gear or as part of a rotor in a bacteria, for example, and they take a bacteriophage that has a flagella on it, has a tail on it. Once that process starts, it kind of signals everything to say, okay, I need these proteins at this particular time. I need these other proteins at this other particular time. I need these, yet a third or a fourth protein at a specific time. And it's all very, very specifically timed. If it wasn't, you'd have chaos. And you wouldn't get built what you wanted to get built. Now, obviously, we're talking about, you know, microorganism here. So,
yeah, but we are talking about organisms, and the same principle would pertain to larger, more complex organisms like man. If this didn't work, we would die.
Yeah, exactly. And so the concept, for example, that all of this is random is ludicrous. Because the more we delve into biological systems, the more we find that things aren't left to chance at all. I mean, there's nothing that's left to chance. So if nothing is left to chance, then if your assumption is that everything came about by chance, but what you see is that everything is very systematic and organized and timed, and if one thing is out of place, it doesn't work. You have to come to the conclusion that maybe your initial assumption is incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were honest with yourself, that's what you would actually have to conclude. And that instead of, well, we just came about by random chance, we came about by some extremely sophisticated engineer, in this case a bioengineer, or if you're looking out into space, a astroengineer, you know, an astrophysicist, far beyond any capability that we have, you know, today. And then, of course, you know, the ultimate conclusion is that, yes, there God created everything because of the order that we see. You know, the scripture says that the heavens declare the glory of God. Well, if they knew, you know, about microorganisms and about biology and about the stuff that we know today, another similar phrase would be, my goodness, you know, biology screams the glory of God.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's not like, oh, yeah, there's a bunch of stars out there and they seem to be organized and they seem to be, you know, rotating about each other and those type of things. But if you look at biology, I mean, it screams the glory of God.
Explain the law of irreducible complexity. Because that enters into this, because we have thousands of these elements built into every cell and every human body and every organism and every, and that includes plants, in such a way that if any one part of it were not present, the whole system would fall apart.
The first example of that was the bacteria flagella, for example. It is actually a very complex rotary motor. It's made up of 40 different types of proteins, and if any one of those proteins were defective, the motor wouldn't work. So, for example, if you look at a flagella, a bacteria flagella under the microscope when it's working, it looks like the tail is kind of wagging back and forth. But it actually is spinning. And it's spinning at 100,000 revolutions per minute.
Hmm.
It can stop and then spin. It can stop like on a dime and then spin in the other direction 100,000 RPMs. This is a very sophisticated rotary engine or rotary motor, the likes of which we can't even make ourselves because we don't have the components to make something that is, to balance and everything. The thing would shake itself apart if it went that fast. Mm-hmm. So here's an example. Those Friday proteins, if you take one of them out or if you even mutate one of them, the system doesn't work. Or, as in our example here today, if the parts, as you are building them, don't come together in a specific time frame that the part is needed, it doesn't get built and it doesn't function. So one would say, then, I can't build this thing through evolution because the whole system needs to be in place for it to function. And without the system being in place, there is no advantage to the organism. Matter of fact, there's a disadvantage because a tail, a flagella, that is not working for a bacteria is a detriment to the bacteria because it's going to starve to death. It can't swim through the water as it's supposed to do in order to collect food and go about its business. So it has no locomotion, and it would actually be a hindrance.
And it dies and would not then contribute its gene pool to descendants. I mean,
yes,
the species exactly. Would end if it wasn't all working to begin with.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's just one example that a lot of study has been done. But there, I mean, every part of our body has irreducibly complex components to it. I mean, the eye is another thing. I mean, you can't, it's got thousands, if not millions and billions of photoreceptors. And there's two different types of photoreceptors. You've got the rods and the cones. I mean, and each one of those plays a specific role. And they're not only randomly distributed, they are distributed in such a way that there's more rods, for example, in your peripheral vision than there are and more cones in the central vision. The cones are for color vision and the rods are for black and white. The rods are very much more sensitive than the cones. And so when you go to night vision, for example, you can see things not necessarily in living color, mm-hmm. but you can still see because the rods are doing their job of receiving more photons and are more sensitive than the cones. Well, the distribution of just those, the rods and the cones is designed. And not only the rods themselves or the cones themselves, to respond to different frequencies of light, and then the light gets transmitted as electrical impulse, and those impulses go to the brain. Certain sections of the brain are obviously responsible for light, for our sight. So the eye, for example, is an extremely complex organism, which wouldn't function if it wasn't all there present at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. The word ludicrous came up, and that seems to be apropos to think that these thousands or millions of devices of bio clocks and proteins all developed simultaneously by chance to create the final product. Well, it's ludicrous.
Well, it is ludicrous, and you can think of even in the womb, for example, if the heart didn't start beating at a very, very early age, mm-hmm. For example, things wouldn't start coming together as they're supposed to come together. And the body, the growing fetus wouldn't develop. And obviously that you'd have major problems. But something starts that, mm-hmm. Something starts that heart from beating. It's it's not, a whole lot of, muscle fiber at that particular point, but something kicks it in. And starts the process and says, now is the time to start this heart beating, mm-hmm. To start this muscle contracting, and start the process.
I saw something recently about about the process of birth, and I don't remember where it was now, but that was something that I'd never heard of or never seen before, that the fetus coexists in the mother's womb for a long period of time, sharing back and forth, and up until that point, the entire system is immersed in liquid. But there's a certain point at a time just before birth when the lungs start to function and the heart kicks in. That's just something that I've never learned before. I'd never seen that before. And I said, wow, that's incredible. That's amazing. Way too much for an accident. Most of us have never really gone through the thinking of how you're explaining it, and I've seen that example before, is that there's no way, particularly with Creation Moments.
Ian Taylor, yeah.
Yeah, Ian Taylor. And all these things have to come. It's not just two things that have to come together, and that's just three or four, but it's thousands, maybe millions.
You see these same bio clocks in the birth process then to bring things to fruition to the time when the baby emerges into a whole new world and functions differently than it has been for the preceding 9 months. When is it ready? It gets ready for that. It's prepared, and it's got to be by design. I can't believe that a true dyed-in-the-wool, rock-ribbed evolutionist is much of a mathematician. Because if you consider the odds on all these things developing, let's say there's a 1 in a billion chance that this particular enzyme would ever be created with its particular characteristics, and then the whole biologic system is dependent on 1,000 of those, each with the same odds of developing. And you have to multiply one set of odds by the next set of odds by the next set of odds thousands of times. Your number would be incomprehensible. And it shouts impossibility. It says it can't evolve that way. It just will not work.
Well, that's what you would think. And, that's a logical conclusion, studying anything that we see around us. Doesn't have to be as complex as us, although, many. it could be, as you say, the universe and the things that we see out in space, or it can be a tree, it could be a plant, it could be just the things, around us. Just the stuff that, in order to support life here on Earth, all the things that had to come together. To support life, the atmosphere, the percentage oxygen, and the tilt to the Earth, the magnetic field around the Earth, all of the stuff that needs to be in place for life to exist, couldn't have just happened. I mean, it had to be. Of course, we can say that because we believe in a creator. It had to be created. It had to be designed. But the more, this is why I like biology so much, is because the more, especially molecular biology and biochemistry, the more you study it, the more we learn that we don't know. I mean, it's just so complex. I could spend, there are scientists that spend their whole careers on one little tiny aspect of a pathway, for example, of a biochemical pathway. And they've identify the enzymes involved, and they identify all of the associated processes that must take place for this thing to work. And even in the midst of that, many of them would say, "Oh, there's no creator. I mean, this just happened by chance." Mm-hmm. And it's mind blowing. It's it's just how could it happen by chance? I mean, it's so complex. Many people do say that. And I say that only because the enemy of our soul has blinded our minds to the truth. And so that really is the ultimate battle, is this spiritual battle that's going on that even the atheists don't understand is happening, and their minds have been blinded to it. It's when we receive you know, we accept that by through faith, which isn't obviously isn't ours to, that God even gives us the faith to believe. It's through faith that we believe that, ah, yes, there is a creator, there is a Lord, there is a designer. And through that faith, then comes the understanding and the wisdom as to, wow, this all this stuff is just amazing.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's I'm not sure that faith is the best word for that. I'm not sure what is. But when you contemplate the big picture, it becomes patently absurd to think that it could have evolved without a designer, without an architect, without an artist, a scientist, an intellect far beyond anything we've ever experienced in our realm here. It is a rational conclusion that there is a God.
It is rational, but even in that rationality, people still don't believe. So if in the light of all of this evidence, and you still don't believe, you have faith that it just happened by chance.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so in order to break that, you have to be unblinded, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scales have to come off of your eyes, so to speak. I mean, obviously, not necessarily literally, but I mean, when I became a Christian, the scales came off of my eyes. I mean, it was like, okay, I've got the evolutionary story down pat. I don't know if there is a God or not, but at least, you know, I've got this story, which makes some sense. Even in the light, I mean, I was studying biochemistry, even in the light of, you know, biochemistry, mm-hmm. it was like, okay, yeah, all right, evolution could, over millions and millions of years, I could see that things could evolve. You can imagine all kinds of stuff. That's what's so great about our minds. We have the ability to imagine all these things. But it wasn't until I accepted the Lord Jesus as my Lord and Savior did I say, aha, this is impossible. I mean, it couldn't have happened just by chance. It had to have been designed. So, you know, that's why I'm just using my own personal experience here as to how I made the transition from an evolutionist to a creationist in a very, very short period of time, just through faith in Jesus.
Well, it's kind of like you've got a lock to open, and you've got this need to unlock this lock, and you've got about a bazillion keys in front of you, and you've got to find the right one. And you try one, and it's close, and it twists in there, but it doesn't unlock. And you try another one, and another one, and another one. You finally come to the key, and it unlocks, and then you open the door, and you can see how everything fits together. You see the patterns. The patterns become visible to you, and you know, that's the supreme aha moment. It's when that hole, you know, humans have been described as having a hole in their heart that only God can fit. That's the key. And once you've got the right answer there, then everything else kind of falls into place. And well, it's an astounding process, yeah, itself.
It does. It's like you were seeing in black and white, and now you see in color, mm-hmm. The world around you, and you say, ah, wow, isn't the world beautiful?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. Indeed you do.
So anyway, it's... yeah, it's a mystery. But the more, as I said, you know, the more we study about these things, the more we find all of these intricate interconnections, even within the simplest of organisms. It turns out that they're not so simple at all. Everything has to be timed just perfectly.
Mm. We're talking about an article written by Dr. Jeffrey P. Tompkins. It's available at the Institute for Creation Research website. That's icr.org. I have a link in our chat window on the Broken Road Radio homepage. You can click on that and read the same article. I think you'll be enlightened. Whether you're a biochemist or not, you'll find this interesting. Dr. Don, of course, a biochemist, and again, a member of the Board of Creation Moments. I want to mention, too, that on our website, you can link to the Creation Moments website. It's creationmoments.org, .com. It's a .com, creationmoments.com. And you'll find a wealth of resources that comprise a scientific explanation of young earth creationism.
One of the things that you just mentioned earlier too is that that brought back an old memory. Back when, in my younger days in a Missouri Synod Lutheran Church, the subject of predestination came up, and I found it an interesting discussion then, and I still do, and with all of these intricate interlocking pieces that have been created to bring us to a certain point, to birth us as a child, to create all the things around us. Is it that difficult to accept the notion or deny the notion that won't cause other things in our lives to happen as well? It gets to be, I mean, especially when you start to, you throw it up against the idea of free choice and free will and making up our own minds and all the rest of that things. I mean, were you predestined to be a guy who grows grapes and makes wine? Mm-hmm. You know? I know that sounds ridiculous, but throughout my entire life, I don't know how many, I went back to college after I got out of the military. I'm sorry, after I got out of the Air Force.
Yeah, that's better. Thank you.
Yeah, and I went back to college, and my first 2 years of college were an absolute disaster, and I was just too young to pay attention. I think I had a CPA just a little bit, or grade average, just a little bit lower than my blood alcohol count. So, but I went to my final 2 years of college, and I had an A+ average. But I spent two semesters and I was bored to tears. And I said, I'll do this one more time, and otherwise I'm going to drive a truck or something. And I stumbled into a broadcasting class and I said, this is it. I'm never leaving this field. I will always be a broadcaster. Well, I left broadcasting three or four times because I got tired of emptying ashtrays or sweeping up the parking lot. But I always came back. And somehow this is always the right fit for me, to be on the air, to be on in a microphone, to be talking, to be, expounding and all the rest of that. How much of that is predetermined?
Well, yeah, I'm not convinced that it's predetermined, but there is a plan and a purpose for you, and whether or not you find it, if you find your groove, you know it. That's God looking out for you and having made you to do something special. And something unique that only you can do. Mm-hmm. And discovering that is the first big task of your life. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it happens when you're 20, but sometimes it happens when you're 60,
And some people never find it.
And some people never find it.
I firmly believe that. Everyone has a, God has a wonderful plan for your life. You just have to figure out what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's part of the fun. And that's a way to evoke a response from you to him. I mean, that's God at work. And you're not satisfied until you found that. And when you do, you click into that groove, and this is where I belong. And it's sad that it doesn't happen for everybody, but there's so much distraction, and that's where this enemy of our soul comes in that Dr. Don has mentioned. There's a force working for that not to happen. So keep that
that's
in mind.
Very, very, very true.
And that does it for our Tuesday morning talk. Thank you, Dr. Don, for your time and your wisdom. And we'll let you get back to wrangling grapes on the grape ranch down there in Garden Valley.
You're quite welcome, and it's been fun as usual.
Have a great day and a great week. We'll talk to you next Tuesday, okay?
Good to see you, Don.
Very good.
Bye-bye.
Good seeing you, folks.